Welcome to episode 180 of the Solemn Monster Sounds Off here on SDScoops.com. It is Sunday, September 25th, 2011. I am the Solemn Monster. Thank you, as always, for listening to the show. Thanks to all of our new listeners, of which we have many, here to the podcast. Been working for part of this weekend on some Sound Off-related stuff, and we got some fun things coming up in the next couple of weeks. I'm actually scheduled to conduct an interview with somebody a little bit later on this week that may possibly air as part of the next show, which would be episode 181. I'm not entirely sure yet, so I'll keep everybody updated on Twitter and Facebook as far as what happens with that. Speaking of 181, just to kind of get it out of the way here, there will be a sound off. I'm expecting to do one for next week, but it will not be on Sunday. I am not going to be here next Sunday, so my hope is that there will be a new show up either Friday or Saturday. So just a little FYI there about that. But with that out of the way, a lot of things to cover here this week. I want to go back in time 1 week to the WWE Night of Champions pay-per-view. Just give some quick thoughts on the matches from this show that I did see. I was able to convince a friend to split the cost of the show with me because I was not interested in paying $44.95 for it. And I'm glad I didn't, or else I think I would have been pretty PO'd by the end of the night. The show was good if you wanted some decent wrestling, but beyond that, it was nothing to really sing home about. Kind of head-scratching is the best way to describe most of the booking up and down the card. So we'll start with the main event and work our way down here. We had the big Triple H CM Punk encounter. No DQ. If Punk wins, Triple H is no longer COO of WWE. And what an overbooked mess this match turned out to be. I made the comment on Facebook that NOC did not stand for a Night of Champions. It stood for a Night of the Clusterfuck here. Boy, you know, Triple H was not kidding in that interview he did bashing UFC when he said that WWE does not need to evolve. We saw that on display here. For the record, I would not have booked Triple H to lose his COO title this quickly, so he had to win this match, but that stipulation never should have been added to the match in the first place. You know, still, there's something very, very wrong to me with John Cena and Triple H standing tall at the end of this pay-per-view here in 2011. Our prayers were actually answered before the match when Michael Cole completely lost his voice and was rendered unable to announce any of the main event. Now, I don't know whether Jim Ross was backstage in Buffalo or if he was watching at home in Oklahoma, but if he was there backstage, there is no excuse for not bringing him out to replace Cole for the main event. Instead, we were left with Jerry Lawler and Booker T, two color guys, mind you. Well, one color guy and one white guy. To do the match by themselves, it just, you know, they were okay. It just didn't work. You know, with a match like this, we've seen it time and time again with a guy like Jim Ross, and it doesn't even have to be Jim Ross. Any really good or competent play-by-play guy, calling a match of this magnitude can make all the difference in the world in making this match feel really, really special or just only so-so. And I think that was one of the things missing in this match, watching at home. Now, if you were in the arena, you really probably didn't give a shit who was on commentary. Although I wonder if WWE was still doing what they did at SummerSlam, where they charge $15 for those headsets for the people in the crowd. I actually didn't read anything about that. So I don't know if it's something they only experimented once, or if they did it at Night of Champions. But again, if I had paid money for a headset while I was already in the building, having paid for a ticket, and I had to pay for a headset to listen to Jerry Lawler and Booker T call the main event, what a jip that would have been. But I did enjoy how they started the match off like a brawl, just beating the holy hell out of one another, which is exactly how it should be done, given how personal it's become between Punk and Triple H. I thought the savage elbow spot by Punk off the top rope through Triple H on the announce desk was really cool. He just nailed it perfectly. So that was probably the cool spot of the match for me. I did have one question that was really puzzling to me, and that was when Miz and R-Truth came down to interfere, which they had foreshadowed earlier in the night that they would possibly be interfering in this match, and we see them basically trying to help, it appears anyway, help Punk beat Triple H. In fact, they put Punk on Triple H, and there was a near fall. Clearly, Miz and Truth are not enamored with Triple H as the COO. They don't think he's very good in the role, and they wanted to try to eliminate him from that position. So in that respect, it made sense. And yet, there was a spot here where CM Punk, a little bit later on, is going for the pinfall on Triple H after nailing him with the GTS. And R-Truth on the outside of the ring yanks Punk out of the ring and off of Triple H, breaking up the pinfall. That just blew my mind. It just doesn't make any sense why he would do something like that. So we had that. I also mentioned on Twitter, of course, we had Kevin Nash come out, which I think I may have mentioned in my predictions. I think last week I predicted he would come out. So John Laurinaitis had come down. It appeared he was texting somebody, and 15 seconds later, here comes Kevin Nash out of the crowd. And Kevin Nash comes in, and he ends up delivering a jackknife powerbomb to CM Punk. And mind you, that now makes three unanswered jackknife powerbombs to CM Punk from Kevin Nash, okay? Aside from a couple of punches here and there, Punk has gotten no offense in on Kevin Nash. So I just wanted to point that out. Nash went to deliver a jackknife on the outside to Triple H through the announce table, which, if he would have done it, it would have reminded me a lot of the spot where Diesel powerbombed Shawn Michaels through the announce desk when they had their big pay-per-view match back at the Good Friends Better Enemies show in 1996 after WrestleMania. But it was not to be. Triple H nails him with a sledgehammer, leaves him laying, comes in, and gives Punk what would have been the third pedigree of the match and gets the pinfall 1-2-3. Paul Heyman actually tweeted after the show was over that it took three pedigrees and a jackknife to beat CM Punk, which is true. I mean, if they were going to beat Punk, at least it took a lot to put him down. You know, not like Triple H beating Booker T, for example, with one pedigree at WrestleMania 19 and then waiting 45 seconds to crawl over for the pin and getting the pin. It wasn't anything quite that egregious, but it still left a sour taste in my mouth. So, good match. Really good match, even. Not a great match. Definitely nothing compared to the Triple H Undertaker match at WrestleMania this year. But still, two really good matches for Triple H this year. It's amazing the quality of matches you can have when you only wrestle twice a year. It's amazing. John Cena and Alberto Del Rio for the WWE Championship. This was the one finish on this show that absolutely disgusted me. There was no good reason whatsoever to not only take the title off Del Rio after months of building him up, but to put it right back on John Cena for the 89th time. And I don't even know that they have their championship history in order, because I could swear that a month ago they were referring to John Cena as a 10-time WWE champion. Now, I assume that somebody misspoke, and in actuality, you know, this is his 10th WWE title. He's got, I think, two world title reigns. The way that they kind of mix the two of that, it's very, very confusing. You know, he was a 10-time WWE champion a month or two ago, based on everything the announcers were saying, and now they're saying he's a 10-time champion now. So what is it? Is he a 10-time champion? Is he an 11-time? I'll tell you what, I think he's actually a 34-time champion, but we've just kind of lost track of all the reigns. Anyway, I guess I don't really have much more to say about this. This just made me very angry, and I guess the only thing missing were the balloons and the confetti at the end of this match, but I guess they couldn't drop all of that debris because they had one more match left. So, yeah, this match might have been really good, but it was just completely ruined by the outcome, which completely sucked. What did not suck was the World Heavyweight Championship match between Mark Henry and Randy Orton. They didn't have a great match or anything like that, but it's amazing how a well-worked finish can really change one's perception of a match. You know, the match with Cena and Del Rio as compared to Orton and Henry was probably night and day. Orton and Del Rio probably had a five-star classic compared to this, but the outcome is really what matters at the end of the day, and in this match, they put Mark Henry over like $1 million. Randy Orton is the only other guy on the active roster who you could possibly call, you know, they call Cena Super Cena. Well, Orton is not that far behind. I mean, I could probably count on one hand the number of clean jobs that Randy Orton has done in the last couple of years in WWE. And he went to execute the RKO to Mark Henry. Mark Henry shoved him off, picked him up, gave him the what I believe was the second World's Strongest Slam, pinned him clean, 1-2-3, right in the middle of the ring. I popped huge for the finish of this match, and to me, this was the highlight of the entire pay-per-view. They should have ended the whole pay-per-view with this. Mark Henry cut a promo afterwards. Josh Matthews came in, and Henry was, he was angry. Nobody believed in him. He doesn't want the people to cheer him. They don't deserve to celebrate with him, basically, and he said that nobody's going to beat him. He's never losing the championship, which was a lie. But he's a heel, so he can get away with that. This was great. I said last week I wanted Mark Henry to win. I did not think he would. because, you know, basically in the shows leading up to the pay-per-view, Orton was laid out at the end of every show. You know, Henry laid him out with a chair on Raw. Henry left him laying at the end of that big pull-apart brawl on SmackDown. And typical WWE 101 formula would dictate that, well, if somebody was left laying at the end of a show, let alone two shows heading into the pay-per-view, that person is probably going to get a big victory at the pay-per-view. It's that kind of even-steven booking. And I still expect Orton to get the belt back soon enough, but I was thoroughly impressed by the outcome of this match. Mark Henry deserves a run. I mean, he's not a great wrestler. And, you know, ask me this question a couple of years ago, and I don't know that I have the same answer for you. But the reality is, they put the title on so many other guys who either didn't deserve it, it came too quickly, they were really young and didn't have a lot of experience. If they could put the championship on guys like that, they could put the championship on Mark Henry, who they have built up tremendously as a huge monster the last couple of months. And to me, this is something you can keep going for a couple of months. I hear murmurs of, you know, keeping Henry strong, maybe even keeping the title on him quite possibly until WrestleMania, and putting him in the ring with The Undertaker. And I'm sure that if they did that, it would be a better build than what they had for the match that Undertaker and Mark Henry had at WrestleMania back in 06. But I really hope that Mark Henry is not The Undertaker's opponent at WrestleMania. So hopefully those rumors are just that. Kelly Kelly and Beth Phoenix for the Divas Championship. They were in Buffalo, Beth's hometown, and boy, did she get a hero's welcome coming down to the ring. The crowd hated Kelly with a passion. They wanted badly for Beth to win the title. And you would think that that would be the finish, given that Beth Phoenix already lost once to Kelly Kelly just last month at SummerSlam, but you would be wrong if that's what you thought. Now, here's my thought on the whole situation. I know a lot of people were very upset about the finish of this match. It's one thing to say, you know what, give her the title because it's her hometown. You know, that isn't always a valid excuse to have somebody go over. But Kelly beat her with basically the exact same finish 1 month earlier at SummerSlam. You're trying to get over the Divas of Destruction gimmick with Beth and Natalya. Beth absolutely should have won here. And to me, this was simply the wrong outcome. I mean, supposedly WWE feels that Kelly is starting to get over as champion. She's improving. And that may well be true. I'm not even saying that's not the case. But that's no reason to keep the title on her. If anything, take the title off of her. You know, it's all in the chase, as they say. I mean, granted, nobody's going to pay money to see a Divas feud at this point. In fact, the only Divas feud I can remember in recent memory that actually made me excited to follow what was going on in that division was probably Trish and Mickey Psycho James back in 2006. They really haven't given us anything compelling since then. But still, even if Kelly is getting over, that's fine. She can drop the title to Beth. Beth is the heel. Granted, she was being cheered like a babyface, but so what? It's not as though this has never happened before. And have Kelly chase and eventually win back the championship if that's the way you want to go. But to do the same finish 2 months in a row, regardless of whether it was Beth's hometown, to me was just the wrong thing to do. Air Boom and Miz and R-Truth had a tag team match for the championship. The story here was the referee kept messing up and favoring the tag champs. Miz used the skull-crushing finale on Evan Bourne. The referee was arguing with R-Truth at the time. Bourne kicked out. Miz threw the referee down and was disqualified for doing so. And then after the match, R-Truth slapped the referee across the face. This and their post-match promo both played into their conspiracy theory and built to their interference, as I mentioned later on in the main event. This was, whatever. This was what it was. Cody Rhodes and Ted DiBiase had a match for the Intercontinental title. DiBiase pulled off Cody's protective mask and went to nail him with it, but Rhodes ducked, and he's schoolboy DiBiase for the pin. And whatever, it was an okay match, nothing special. And the big thing here is that this finish did DiBiase no favors. Really, it didn't do anyone any favors, because there was no decisive winner. You know, Cody had to steal a win from a glorified job guy here. How does this help him? And to think, you know, here's a guy in DiBiase who no greater authority than John Cena himself once said would be headlining a WrestleMania within a couple of years. Too bad Cena is not as good at prognosticating as he is at winning championships. Dolph Ziggler, Jack Swagger, John Morrison, and Alex Riley, fatal four-way for the U.S. title. It was a good match. Finish saw Swagger use the Dr. Bomb on Morrison, but Ziggler tackled Swagger, knocked him outside, and stole the pinfall to retain the U.S. title. Again, you know, a finish that I guess, is fine for a heel, I suppose, but it really just doesn't do anybody any favors. I guess it furthers whatever the issue is between Cody, between Dolph and Swagger, but I think I said last week, this storyline completely sucks. I just cannot get into it at all. They have not given us anything compelling. They've just burned it into our brain that these guys really don't matter. They're not important. Nobody cares. I like Dolph. I do. He's got a lot of charisma. Comes out. He's always dressed really sharp. He's kind of witty, you know, on the microphone. He's pretty good. But they've got to give us a reason to really care about these guys. I just feel like they haven't done that yet. So that was your card, Night of Champions. Certainly not the worst pay-per-view in the world, but was it worth $45? Well, I'll leave that up to you to decide. I didn't pay the $45. I paid a little bit less, so I was completely okay with that. Now, one of the big stories to come out this week, I want to talk about this here, is WWE potentially abandoning their existing pay-per-view model in the very near future. WWE sent out a survey a couple of days ago polling different ideas for their upcoming 24-hour cable network that Vince McMahon has basically barked orders to people that he wants this network operational by the end of 2012. And Vince was in no mood to be messed with this week. And so when he says he wants something, you better get on that wagon there and get it done. And so they're scrambling to get everything in order and to get their ducks in a row and all, you know, all the programming digitized and all that stuff. And they send this survey out. And the way they describe what the WWE network would be, for those people who have asked me, is it going to be a regular cable channel with commercials and all this? And maybe it'll have commercials. I mean, it's WWE. I'm sure it will. At least it'll have WWE commercials. But apparently their idea for this network is that it would be something very similar to a pay channel, a premium channel, like an HBO or a Showtime or something along those lines. And it would cost anywhere from $7 to $12 a month. And comparatively, their on-demand channel, of which I am a subscriber, at least on my cable service, costs, I believe, an extra $7 a month. And it's totally worth it. So apparently the fee that one would pay would be part of a package. So you're not just getting the WWE Network. What they want is for the WWE Network to be lumped into a package that includes other channels like the NFL Network, the NBA Network, Fuel TV, maybe one or two other channels. So their goal here is they know it's going to be very difficult to get clearances and coverage on a lot of different cable companies. It's going to be very, very hard. So they want to offer something extravagant. Okay, they're dangling the carrot, which I'll get to in a second. And they want to make sure, they want to include their channel in another package. So you're not just getting the WWE Network. They figure more people will be willing to pay the fee because you're getting more than just that. Maybe you're getting the NFL Network or something that is a little bit more attractive. It would offer 24 hours of programming. They would have a mixture of classic shows, some current shows that would not include Raw and SmackDown, although there may be Raw and SmackDown replays from what I understand. And original content, there's talk of maybe some sort of cooking show with the Big Show and his wife. You may recall I reported a long time ago that they had either filmed or had intended to film some sort of comedy sitcom pilot involving Santino Marella and Vladimir Kozlov. I've had a couple of people in recent weeks actually email me asking me about the status of that. I had not heard anything, and Kozlov is not even in WWE anymore. But supposedly it's something they're considering, perhaps revisiting that idea, not necessarily with Kozlov, but some sort of sitcom-type program involving Santino, some sort of reality show perhaps where the wrestlers have to live in a house together, which would be... It would be a train wreck, but it would be entertaining as hell, I'm sure. And anyway, so all of those things are on the table for the network. And the biggest shock, I guess, to come out of this, the biggest news to come out of this, is that WWE would apparently have an interest in taking their four biggest pay-per-view events, traditionally, the big four, as they say, Royal Rumble, WrestleMania, their crown jewel, SummerSlam and Survivor Series, and moving it on to the network. So it would be exclusive content to subscribers of the WWE channel. They would no longer be offered on pay-per-view. Perhaps a replay would be, but not the first-run programming. Yet their B-show pay-per-views, the Money in the Banks and the TLCs and Capital Punishment and those types of shows, would still be offered on pay-per-view. This, of course, makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. I mean, it just... It almost, to me, here's what I think about this whole thing for people who have said, oh, is this real? Is this actually going to happen? I don't buy any of this bullshit for a second, okay? I do not see WWE taking WrestleMania. A show that did over 1 million pay-per-view buys this year will probably top that next year for the Rock Cena match in Miami. And taking that show off of pay-per-view and making it exclusive content for a new network in a couple of years. Anything's possible, of course, you know, if pay-per-view buy rates were to suddenly plummet, but in the case of WrestleMania in particular, it's their biggest pay-per-view of the year. Why would you take a show like that, put it on a network that I have very serious doubts is going to get very many clearances, at least initially? It's going to be very, very hard to get this network in as many homes as they want it to be in. So you're going to have a ton of people out there who do not have the WWE Network or who cannot pay a monthly fee for a package that includes the WWE Network, who are going to be shit out of luck if they want to watch WrestleMania. I find that extremely difficult to believe. So the game I think they're playing is this. They realize how tough it's going to be, and they want to make a huge splash. They want to really make this whole WWE Network idea very attractive to the cable companies and the cable providers. So their initial idea, and this is just an idea, this was a survey, okay? This does not mean that this is actually what they're going to do. But make the announcement, say that your initial offerings on a new network will include these four pay-per-views, traditionally the four biggest shows of the WWE calendar year. And when the network actually comes to fruition, there's nothing stopping WWE from saying, you know what, we've made a change. Instead of offering the Rumble and SummerSlam and Mania and all of these shows, we're going to instead offer shows like Over the Limit, Extreme Rules, Elimination Chamber. I think it would make a lot more sense to make a complete 180 on this and do it the opposite way that I just talked about. Take your B-show pay-per-views, which have been struggling mightily now for many, many years. I mean, these B-shows are just dying a death on pay-per-view. And take those shows, which still have some special value. It's still a pay-per-view that ordinarily you'd have to pay $45 or $55 for. Take those shows and put them on your network, even just half of those shows if you don't want to take them all. But don't take your four biggest pay-per-views of the year, and I use that term loosely with Survivor Series because that show has not done very well in recent years, but don't take your biggest shows off of pay-per-view because how are you making up for all that lost revenue? That's what I want to know. You know, this is just a survey. They haven't exactly made that clear. How are you making up for all the money you're going to lose by taking these shows off of pay-per-view and putting them on a network that probably nobody is even going to get, at least not at first? So that's what I think this is all about. I think they want to make this attractive. They want to make it as attractive as possible, but they're not actually going to follow through on this. They cannot be that dumb. Economically speaking, there are people who work for that company behind the scenes that you and I have never heard of, people that actually know a little bit about business who I don't think would ever greenlight something like this because on the surface, it doesn't make any sense. You know, there's been a big question for a while now. Is pay-per-view a dying business? Okay, it's been a very big debate. Wrestling shows have not been doing as well in recent years as they did 5-10 years ago, which to me goes hand-in-hand with the downfall creatively of the product. You know, if you were offering a more compelling product like you were, let's say, a decade ago, more people would be apt to buy your pay-per-views if they actually felt special, which they don't by and large. Every now and then you'll get a golden nugget that comes along, like the build-up to John Cena and CM Punk at Money in the Bank, which definitely helped the buy rate for that show, but not even by as much as I thought it would, quite frankly, because people have a certain stigma about these B-shows because they've been conditioned to think that nothing important happens on these shows, even though I think if you look at all the B-shows from this year and maybe in recent years, there's been tons of title changes on the B-shows. You know, before you would very rarely see that. And, you know, really, there's no distinct difference anymore between the, quote, A shows and the B shows. It's just the name, you know. And again, there's a certain stigma attached to it. But, you know, the whole thing about is pay-per-view a dying business, I point to UFC. I point to boxing, and I rest my case. Boxing is a dying sport. Boxing does not have very many money attractions. You know, you have Money Mayweather, you've got Manny Pacquiao. That one fight between Mayweather and Pacquiao, it's disgusting how much money the boxing promoters, the fighters, and everybody involved would make off that fight if they could ever book the damn thing. But the reality is, for as shitty as boxing may be, quite frankly, right now compared to how it used to be, you know, Floyd Mayweather just had a fight with Victor Ortiz, a guy that nobody probably even knew his name. I certainly didn't know his name, but I admit I'm not really a boxing fan. And that fight, apparently, in the preliminary estimates anyway, indicate that it did well over 1 million pay-per-view buys. That's incredible. UFC shows. You know, some of the UFC pay-per-views of late have not done all that great, although they're still doing way better than most WWE shows. But when you get a really good UFC fight, a really good, like a stacked card, or even if it's just one or two really huge fights on an otherwise very basic card, okay, when you have that one big mega fight, for example, UFC is going to be promoting a big fight between Brock Lesnar and his big comeback against Alistair Overeem at the end of the year on December 30th in Vegas, I believe. Now, I don't know what other fights they're going to put on that pay-per-view, but it doesn't matter. Because if both fighters stay healthy and the fight happens, that right there is, to me, a million-buy show for UFC right there. Okay? And they've done other pay-per-views that have bested 1 million. They've done some that have done, let's say, 700,000 or 800,000. That's big business right there. So explain to me why UFC can get numbers like that, but WWE can't, so therefore pay-per-view is a dying business. It's bullshit. It's a crutch. It is a crutch for wrestling promoters and people in wrestling who don't want to admit to their own problems. They don't want to admit they don't know. Apparently, they forgot overnight how to book wrestling. People like Vince McMahon that have had decades in the business, who people used to refer to and still do in some cases as being some sort of maniacal genius. This maniacal genius can't seem to figure out how to turn certain aspects of his business around. So he makes other people's lives miserable. He gets a 2.7 rating for one Raw show, and then decides to switch up the championships and change his mind 1 million more times. That's no way to book wrestling. To keep changing your mind from 1 week to the next, if you've got a story you want to build, then build it. I mean, that's how you get people invested in what you're doing. Wrestling, you tell stories, okay? UFC, they can tell stories too, but it's more of a real sport. They don't have as much control over things as WWE does. You know, somebody can get injured, they could pull out of a fight. You can have a great fight on paper, and you spend $60 to order a pay-per-view, you invite 12 friends over, have a great time, and the fight starts and somebody gets knocked out and 5 seconds later it's over. That's kind of the point that I guess Triple H was trying to make with his comments a couple of weeks back about UFC. And you know what? That's absolutely true. That's one of the advantages that wrestling has over any other sport or any other form of entertainment. They control their own destiny. They can book the best wrestling card in the world of all time if they wanted to. If they wanted to. If for whatever reason they just don't seem to want to do that. They're always changing their minds. They're giving us fuck finishes. You know, they're promoting some sort of match or a feud, and a month later it's over and they move on to the next flavor of the month. And they wonder why their pay-per-view business has declined. It's not because pay-per-view is dying. It's because you don't know what you're doing. But apparently they've got it in their head that they've got to make some changes to their pay-per-view model and the way they do business. And if so, that's fine. But this whole plan as outlined in the survey is complete bullshit. And I guarantee you that Royal Rumble and Mania and all these shows are not moving to the WWE Network. Not in the next 3 or 4 years anyway. It's not going to happen. Let's talk about Raw from last week. Kind of a newsworthy show. The big news on the show, Miz and R-Truth were fired by Triple H at the end of the show. Mark Henry legitimately injured Jerry Lawler, at least for one night. Get to that in a second. And Hugh Jackman, Wolverine himself, put over Zack Ryder in a big way. On the whole, I thought this was a pretty good show, actually. We'll start with the good. Color me surprised, but Hugh Jackman, speaking of which, he was really good on this show. You know, it helps that he used to be a big fan. He was genuinely excited to be there. All the reports online, you know, the wrestlers backstage loved him, and he introduced himself to everybody. And some people were saying that of all the guests, they still call them guest hosts. He's not a host. Now they just call them guest stars. Of all the celebrities that they've had, he may have been the very best. And he looked like he was just having a blast out there. You know, he even went on his Twitter page, Hugh Jackman did, before the show, and was talking about how it was a lifelong dream. And then after the show, he actually posted a photo of himself backstage with Steve Lombardi, who he saw wrestle as the Brooklyn Brawler in Australia back in 1986. And I never would have predicted in a million years that Wolverine would come to a WWE show and would mark out over meeting the Brooklyn Brawler. But it's a strange world we live in. I thought that using Jackman, by the way, to give the rub to Zack Ryder was fantastic. Just great, great stuff. You know, he even wore the Broski headband at ringside for Ryder's match with Dolph Ziggler. And I'd be in favor of making him Ryder's full-time manager after his performance on Monday night. You know, make him an offer, Vince. Make him an offer he can't refuse. It's also worth noting, as I did on Twitter during the show, that Hugh Jackman throws a better punch than John Cena does. Just stating the facts. And I know there's a whole controversy about how, you know, it wasn't a worked punch. He actually punched Ziggler very hard in the face, and Ziggler went on Twitter and claimed that he had a hairline fracture of his jaw, which I doubt that very seriously. I guess nobody knows for sure. Supposedly, he did not get a fracture, but he did kind of get walloped by Jackman. It looked like a hell of a punch, so it wouldn't shock me if it was a little stiff. But I don't think he broke or fractured anything. I think it's all BS. On the flip side, Hugh Jackman was great, but WWE also announced that the Muppets are going to be appearing on the Halloween edition of Raw on October 31st. And the only thing I have to say about this is that if Randy Orton can convince his friend Barney the Dinosaur to appear, and John Cena can coax his nephews, the Teletubbies, out of retirement, we're going to have a hell of a party on Halloween. Can't wait for that. Mark Henry. I really liked the Mark Henry segment on this show, and I thought it was very effective in getting him over as an even bigger heel monster. And I'm still not a fan of them punking Jim Ross out all the time. I think it can be effective, but they harass and they embarrass the poor guy so many times. I mean, every other week, it doesn't really mean much. But there were two things I did not like about this segment. One were the goddamn what chants, which just nearly ruined the entire promo for me. Until the very end, when Henry did a great job of quieting everybody down as he got more intense. You know, you still heard some what chants, but they weren't as many, and then it got lower and lower and lower, and you know, people could sense something bad was about to happen, and they shut the hell up at that point. And the other thing that I didn't like was the table bump on Jerry Lawler, who had run in to save JR from certain doom, and Lawler got beat up for his troubles. I didn't find out until the next morning that Lawler was actually legitimately hurt on the spot, but I knew watching it on Monday night that he might be hurt because it looked very, very stiff. You know, when Henry went to slam him through the table, just the way it looked brutal. And, I mean, let's be honest, Lawler's over 60 years old. He doesn't look it. I mean, for his age compared to other... I mean, you put Jerry Lawler and Ric Flair side by side, and I think Lawler and Flair are the same age, or they're within a year of each other, I think. They're both in their early 60s. You put them side by side, and it's quite a sobering image. And although sober is not a word I would use with Ric Flair, but that's beside the point. But it was very uncomfortable to watch, and I do think that it was a big part of why the segment worked so well, true, but it was very, very rough. The other thing I didn't, the other thing I couldn't help but think of was what an asshole John Cena really is. That's the first thought that went through my head. Randy Orton, too, for that matter. Where the hell was Orton? But where was Cena? I mean, Orton, I guess, was selling injuries. He was not on the show on Monday night. Although, for whatever reason, he was on SmackDown this week. So, you know, he took one World's Strongest Slam at the pay-per-view. Actually, I think he took two. Okay, but he got beat with one. It's not like Henry attacked his ankle or his leg after the match like he did with Kozlov and Kane and Big Show. Don't tell me that Orton was too injured to show up on Raw, but he wasn't there. But John Cena was, and John Cena is the babyface, you know, king of the company, the face of the company, and we know he was there. He was obviously at the show. And you know, JR is getting punked out, Lawler is getting the hell beaten out of him, and John Cena is nowhere to be found. The big hero of the company, and he doesn't come down to help. What an asshole. Main event on this show was Cena the asshole, and CM Punk against Miz and R-Truth. I did find it funny how when Punk came out in the opening segment, he was limping very badly from the night before. He was selling how brutalized he was in that match with Triple H. What a war the two of them had gone through just 24 hours earlier. And yet here in this match, he showed absolutely no signs of limping whatsoever. I guess it was the adrenaline that kicked in. This was a really good match, marred only by the longest sell job I have ever seen in the history of mankind by John Cena. I mean, he just got beaten up forever, and it went on and on and on, to the point where the crowd kind of went silent during the match. And then he got the hot tag to Punk. Punk cleaned house. He ended up pinning Miz with the GTS. And that's when Triple H came out. He fired Miz and R-Truth. Backstage, they attacked Triple H from behind and had to be pulled off by the rest of the locker room, who then threw them out of the building. So there you go. The bad on this show, CM Punk being back in the title picture is not a bad thing. But the idea that Triple H beat him, got his win, and now Punk doesn't get to exact revenge is kind of a letdown. You know, I mean, I'm fine with holding off a rematch if they want to between Triple H and Punk for a bigger pay-per-view, if that's what they're going to do. But Punk didn't seem nearly as upset as he should have been that Triple H pinned him the night before. In fact, it was Triple H that got up in Punk's face and threatened to throw down in the opening segment on this show. And Punk basically said, hey, put your tie back on. You know, I don't want to fight you. He didn't seem too interested in fighting Triple H. He should be demanding a rematch on the spot after what happened to him the night before. Whether he blames Triple H for it or not, Punk got screwed, even though it did take three pedigrees. But he did not seem nearly as upset as he should have been here in this segment. Also, Kelly and Eve Torres beat Beth Phoenix and Natalya after Eve rolled up Natalya for the pin on this show. And this makes absolutely no sense to me. I mean, just apparently they're thinking about breaking up Beth and Natalya, based on everything I'm seeing here. I mean, they keep losing. They're getting increasingly frustrated. You know, at some point, who can take them seriously? It just, I don't know. I don't know where they're going with this, but I don't like what I'm seeing so far. And it was bad enough they had Beth lose for the second straight month the exact same way to Kelly Kelly, a girl half her size. But, I mean, now they're turning the Divas of Doom into the Divas of Dirt. I mean, they're not very intimidating anymore. They keep losing like this. So hopefully next week they'll just come out and just kill everybody. Just kill all the women on the show. Everybody. Vicky, Kelly, Eve. I guess Gail's not there anymore. But, yeah. Sucks to be John Morrison these days. That's the other thing on this show that I would put in the bad category. What more is there to say, really, about Morrison? You know, he was beaten in less than a minute by Alberto Del Rio and then quickly forgotten about. And I would say how the mighty have fallen, but I don't really think he was ever that mighty to begin with. Certainly, he wasn't booked to be all that mighty, so it's just one of those things where he gets beat, he'll do a fancy move every now and then, but he'll get beat, and nobody's going to care, and that's just the way it's going to be. They do that with a lot of guys. I also thought that was quite a magic trick played by Cody Rhodes during this show on Monday night. He came out for a match. One minute you see him, the next minute you don't. He just kind of vanished. And that's your Intercontinental Champion for you right there. In the ugly category, Alberto Del Rio mentioned Vince McMahon's name on the show during a backstage segment with Triple H, which, based on various reports, caused Vince to combust. And I find this rather amusing, given that the line had to be written for Del Rio, and yet he took as much of the blame for this as the writer himself did, apparently. I want to know, how does Vince micromanage these scripts the way he does every single week and not catch something like that? Shouldn't he be yelling at himself? So, that was the only thing. It wasn't even anything that happened on screen. You know, Vince's meltdown happened behind the scenes. There was really nothing ugly on this show. I thought overall it was a pretty good effort. And with WWE, it's very, very maddening, because you'll have a good show one week, maybe even a great show. And then next week, it's like, you can't even believe the same person booked this show. So I'm going to reserve judgment until next week if they're experiencing some sort of creative turnaround here. But for one week anyway, they did give us a good show. I want to talk a little bit about SmackDown now that we've gotten Raw out of the way. And the question, is SmackDown dying right before our very eyes? First and foremost, I posted a link to an uncensored batch of photos of a bloody Cody Rhodes on my Twitter. You can go to @Solomonster on Twitter. Apparently, Orton and Cody had a match, and Cody Rhodes got busted open by a ring bell shot, hard way, outside the ring by Randy Orton, and bled an absolute gusher. And apparently it was the worst juice people have seen since Eddie Guerrero at Judgment Day with JBL back in 2004. I remember watching that match, and JBL and Eddie are on the outside, and JBL comes out of nowhere, out of camera view, and just wallops Eddie Guerrero in the head, just straight away, right in the head, with a steel chair. It made a sickening thud. Guerrero falls down in a heap, obviously cuts himself. When the camera goes back on him, he is just losing pints of blood by the second. It was disgusting. And by the time that pay-per-view was over, because they had gone back into the ring to fight some more, JBL did a blade job as well. There was blood. I mean, the entire mat was just soaked in blood. And apparently, and JBL has said this in one of his blogs on his Facebook page, he made the comment that Eddie was not himself for some time after that. It wasn't like, wow, he really cut himself deep, had to get stitched up, and that was the end of it. He lost a lot of blood that night and was not the same for a long time. And in this case, Cody did not cut himself because obviously blading is banned right now in WWE. And, you know, you watch that Eddie Guerrero match and you realize why that is. But I would say, based on my seeing it, at least from those photos, I would say that it ranks pretty high up there with some of the worst I've ever seen in terms of WWE, at least. I mean, Vince McMahon at Survivor Series 2003 had a buried alive match with The Undertaker. And it was within the first 3 minutes of the match, if that, that Vince bladed. And he must have cut an artery because he was just leaking blood. And it's one thing, again, Vince at the time was, you know, he was an older man. This was back in 03, so he was in his 50s. And he's having this match with Undertaker. It's your main event of the pay-per-view. It's going to go on for a little bit of time. And for Vince to cut himself in the first 2 or 3 minutes of the match and bleed the way that he was bleeding, he lost a lot of blood. It was sick. So I remember that one. And probably the other one that was really bad is Undertaker and Brock Lesnar had a Hell in a Cell match at No Mercy back in 2002. And Undertaker really put Brock over strong in that match. And Undertaker bladed, he bled, and again, it was just disgusting. Just blood everywhere, wearing the proverbial crimson mask. You couldn't even tell if it was a white guy or a black guy or what. Undertaker was just, his entire face was just completely covered in blood, just drenched. And that was probably one of the sicker bloodbaths I've ever seen in WWE. So anyway, Cody Rhodes, he got bloodied up pretty good at the SmackDown tapings. Of course, when the match aired on television, it was heavily, heavily edited. And it's a shame, actually, because it's one thing if you want to edit certain parts out of it. But to me, when you're handed something like this, use it to your advantage. You know, Randy Orton has not been in the right frame of mind. He's obviously very upset. He lost the World Heavyweight Championship. You're trying to put over the fact that Orton is in this crazed state. He's upset. He wants his belt back. It would have helped to have shown most of this, I think, on television. No editing, no black and white, none of that stuff. Just Orton is out there. He's brutalizing Cody Rhodes, leaving him in a pool of his own blood. And blood can be very effective when it is used selectively. So in this case, he got busted open. It was an accident. Shit happens. Use it to your advantage. You know, it wasn't any sort of edict from Sci-Fi Network. It's WWE's own self-imposed edict where blading is banned. Blood is banned. Well, there was no blading involved here. Orton got cut open. It was a deep cut. And you could have used it to your advantage. And WWE chose not to do that. So that was a shame. But the bigger story here when it comes to SmackDown are these SmackDown tapings of late. On Tuesday, WWE taped SmackDown at the Nutter Center in Dayton, Ohio. I love that name, by the way. The Nutter Center. I will always know the Nutter Center when I hear that name as being the location of the King of the Ring, the first King of the Ring pay-per-view in 1993. I just talked about this, actually, a couple weeks ago. I love that venue, and I love that pay-per-view. But anyway, something that WWE does not love is the attendance that they have been getting, or not getting, rather, for SmackDown. Of like, they were in Dayton. They had a very, very poor crowd on Tuesday. There was an entire side of the arena, apparently, that had to be tarped off. And officials from the Nutter Center would not release the attendance information on an order from WWE. So you know that it's bad when WWE basically commands the arena that they just ran, you are not to tell anybody how many people we had at this show. Pictures got online, and it's not a pretty sight. I will say that. This is the second SmackDown taping in 3 weeks to garner very poor attendance. And back on September 6th, almost all of the camera side for the event was a show in Toledo, apparently, also Ohio, was tarped up. So maybe it's just an Ohio thing. Maybe WWE just has to stay the hell out of Ohio. But you look at these photos, and it looks like an indie show. You know, it's just, it's really, really pathetic. So the question is, what do you have to do? You know, should WWE panic? Should they let 2 or 3 shows dictate, you know, them taking action? Should they wait and see what happens? And if so, what should they do? You know, to me, one of the things that would help most likely is to air the show live on Tuesdays and put it over very, very strong on Raw. They had that live SmackDown special around Labor Day time, and it was a one-time experiment. The show did do a better number in the ratings than it would have done on a Friday night, but realistically, I mean, any television show, you know, in prime time is going to do better on a Tuesday than it would on a Friday. Friday is one of the worst nights of the week to be on TV. People go out, they have plans, more people probably DVRing the show. But when they did that live SmackDown, it felt special because you knew it was live, they hyped it up as live, and they hyped the hell out of it on Raw. And they had all their big stars. John Cena wrestled Wade Barrett on the show. I think Orton was on the show. All their top stars were on the show. And I feel like if you want SmackDown to improve, if you want people to look at SmackDown as being must-see television, if you are a WWE fan, whereas a lot of people now feel that perhaps it's okay for them to skip the show, then you've got to move the show to a different night. Going live even is not necessarily something you have to do. It helps. But you got to get that show off of Fridays. And you might ask, well, what does that have to do with attendance in the building? Well, I'll tell you what it has to do with attendance in the building. It's a first step in a process. By moving the show away from Friday night, let's say to Tuesdays, okay, you are going to promote the show extra hard on Monday nights. And it's a better night of the week, so more people will start watching the show on television. The more people who start watching the show on television, they're going to become more familiar with the superstars on SmackDown, and they're going to be more apt to buy a ticket to go to SmackDown when it comes to their town. They'll feel like, wow, I actually know some of the people who wrestle on this show. I actually follow some of the storylines on this show. I'm going to buy a ticket, and I'm going to go to the SmackDown taping when it comes to my town. It's the first step in a process. Another thing I think WWE should consider doing, if they aren't already doing so, is hosting another draft. And believe me, anybody who listens to this show knows that I laugh. I scoff at the idea of a draft every time WWE does one because it's comical. They have a draft. The whole point of a draft is to put guys on one show and to keep them on that show and to try to keep the rosters separate. And WWE has done everything in their power to turn that whole brand split thing into a complete joke. But it's what they do. So you know what? Have a draft. And give SmackDown some real star power, because right now, SmackDown is lacking in the star department. And I know there's been some injuries, I know there's guys that left the company, you know, Chris Jericho is gone, Batista's gone, all these guys you used to have are no longer here. But you've got guys, you know, Miz, for example. Miz was a world champion for many months, he headlined WrestleMania, he has become a main event player in WWE. Is he going to make a difference in terms of getting people to buy tickets or moving ratings? I don't know. But Miz and Truth have been... I like their act. I like what they've been doing, although I guess they've been fired now, so I don't know what they're going to be doing with them. But I've been saying that Miz is ripe for being moved over to the SmackDown brand, because before the stuff started with Truth, and now apparently they're part of this whole main event angle, but Miz had nothing. I mean, he had nothing to do. He went from being a world champion and fighting John Cena to losing the championship and feuding with Alex Riley and losing virtually every match he ever wrestled with Alex Riley. The Miz was going nowhere fast on Raw. And I thought 2 or 3 months ago he should have been moved to SmackDown. You can move a guy like maybe Truth and Miz. Bring some guys up from developmental that know how to work. Bring up Tyler Black from Ring of Honor, you know, the current Seth Rollins. I saw that match he had in FCW against Dean Ambrose, the former John Moxley. Great match. There's no reason they should be bringing guys like Johnny Curtis up from developmental and keeping a guy like Seth Rollins toiling in obscurity down in Florida. Start bringing some guys up that actually know how to work, who have a personality, who could get over on television. You want to make new stars? There's one way of doing it. Bring up guys that actually know what they're doing and have the potential to get themselves over. Put them on SmackDown. Move some names over from Raw to SmackDown. Raw's going to be just fine, okay? Raw is the flagship show. Raw has a certain stigma of being the A show, even when it's not necessarily the A show. That's how people look at it. I'm not saying move all of your stars off of Raw, but you could take a couple of guys, like a Miz, and move them over to the Raw, to the SmackDown brand, okay? Get the show off of Friday nights. Move it to a night of the week where people actually watch television instead of going out and doing other things. Those are certain steps that WWE can take. But at the end of the day, SmackDown's always going to be number two in people's eyes. There's very, very little you're going to be able to do about that. Short of bringing The Rock back full-time and bringing Steve Austin back full-time and putting them on SmackDown every week, okay? Failing that, there's not a whole lot WWE can do to change the perception of SmackDown being number two. And that's fine. SmackDown can be number two, but they can be a strong number two. And WWE has not given us any reason to look at SmackDown as being a strong number two, okay? You might get some better wrestling matches, some longer wrestling matches. You've got guys like Sin Cara and Daniel Bryan on SmackDown. That's all well and good. But there's nothing special about the show. I like that they're giving Mark Henry a push as the world champion, okay? I like that, and I don't want them to take the title off him so soon. I don't think the championship means as much as it used to be, where who your champion is will dictate how many people watch your show or how many people buy a ticket. Back in the day, the world title was great for that. You know, the world title can make all the difference in the world in whether or not the guy was a draw. But today, we have so many championships, and they change hands so often, it doesn't mean shit. You can keep the belt on Mark Henry. Don't take this out on Mark Henry, okay? I fear that at Hell in a Cell, they're just going to put the goddamn belt right back on Randy Orton. They're going to panic because nobody's coming to SmackDown, and that's going to be the end of Mark Henry's push. And that's not the answer. In fact, it's the complete opposite of what they need to do. People are starting to give a shit about Mark Henry. Mark Henry is a legitimately scary man, and they've done a very good job of getting him over as such on television. Don't fuck that up. Don't build guys up only to tear them right back down. And you'll wonder why you only have 500 people coming to a television taping. Ric Flair is set to undergo surgery. He originally had been diagnosed with a burst bursa sac in his elbow coming out of the match with Sting on Impact a couple of weeks ago. Flair had gotten superplexed off the top rope, which was a very bad idea to begin with. And apparently, he thought or was told that it was a torn bursa sac in his elbow. He was doing some media in Boston. Flair was in the news this week. He was with the Boston Red Sox. He presented a TNA replica championship belt to some of the players and all that. And throughout the ceremonial first pitch, his left arm swelled up right after that to twice its normal size. He was in a great deal of pain. He went back to the doctor. They checked it, and that's when they found out that he actually has a torn triceps, which is a very serious injury. And Flair apparently talked to Mike Mooneyham, a reporter at the Charleston Post-Courier newspaper, and told him that he would be undergoing surgery this upcoming week. And if Flair is going to wrestle again with an injury like this, if he can, you know, fully recover from it, you're talking 6 months. I mean, you're talking about a give or take a 6 month recovery. Probably minimum. And quite frankly, I don't think Flair should be wrestling ever again. I think, not that it was a great match, but you know what? It's going to be very hard for Ric Flair to go out on a high note at this point. So just let the match with Sting, okay, your first match with Sting in 10 years, let that match be it. There's something actually quite apropos about the fact that Sting became a star in this business because of one match in one night in 45 minutes back in 1988. Ric Flair helped make Sting a superstar. And all these years later, it would be quite appropriate if in his final wrestling match, Sting was put over by Ric Flair. Not that it was a great match, it wasn't. But I don't need to see Ric Flair wrestling anymore. Ric Flair was always known for actually being pretty injury-free. He's had a couple of injuries over the course of his career, but not too many. For a top guy who has wrestled as many matches as he has over the course of his career and has taken all of those backdrops and all of those slams off the top rope and everything else, Flair has stayed relatively injury-free. And now we're at a point where it's his first match in many months on television. He took one move he obviously should not have taken, and he tears a triceps. And to me, that's a sign from above right there that you need to step out of the ring, leave it alone, call it a day, and move on. So hopefully he'll get that message. But hey, it's Ric Flair. You know that he's not going to get the message. Impact taping spoilers here. I'm not going to go through all of them, just the Sting Hogan stuff, which is the main feud that they're building up in TNA. So these are some taping spoilers from the Knoxville, Tennessee shows they taped. If you don't want to hear about this, just fast forward 5 minutes. The Impact airing on October 6th, which is my birthday, coincidentally. Hulk Hogan comes out. This is the show where Hogan invited everybody to come and join him for what would have been his retirement celebration. Hogan had said on the preview show that he was calling it quits. Hulkamania had come to an end. So on this show, he comes out, and he talks about the fact that he thanked the fans for everything, and, you know, he started crying. There was a thank you Hogan chant. He said, it's time to put Hulkamania to rest. Sting came out. He was wearing a red suit with a Hulkamania t-shirt. Hogan rolled his eyes, and they went back and forth. Sting said he had some footage to prove that Hulk Hogan was full of shit. And he played some video footage of Hogan backstage talking to Eric Bischoff, making fun of the Tennessee crowd and saying that it was all a ploy just to sell merchandise. Knowing Hogan, it was probably a shoot. Hogan got crazy boos from the crowd, apparently. He went after Sting. He said if Sting wants to fight him, he will, and Sting accepted. Sting left, and that was the end of that episode. So the Sting-Hogan match is apparently on after all. There were some rumors that they were considering not doing the match, maybe making it some sort of multiple-man match, and I guess they've decided that they're going to go full throttle with the singles match. October 13th, the Impact that airs on that date, they did the taping already. On that show, Hogan comes out, gets a mixed reaction. Sting gets a big babyface pop, and I guess they were doing a contract signing. And Hogan, you know, knocked over the table during the segment. He made a comment that Sting has been ducking him or dancing around him for 30 years, which, really, 30 years, you say? Okay, if he says so. So they go back and forth, and he said that Sting has, you know, been disrespecting him. He's disrespected him for the last time. They supposedly shook hands. Eric Bischoff came out. There was a distraction. Hogan attacked Sting with a steel chair. And basically the show ends with Hogan leaving Sting laying as the show comes to a close. So Sting and Hogan is your main event at Bound for Glory next month on pay-per-view. Not going to be a pretty match, but is Hogan leaving TNA? Has he re-signed? Is he going to stick around? Nobody seems to know. There's no definitive answer. I argue that even if Hogan is staying in TNA, it doesn't matter. There's no reason for him to win this match. We know it's not going to be a great match. They're going to have to rely on smoke and mirrors and interference and gimmicks and weapons and all that sort of thing. Hogan, I'm sure, he'll probably bleed a gusher. Hogan has bladed before. He's got no qualms about doing it. And there's no reason for him to go over in that match. But you never know with Hogan. You know, you never know what might happen as far as some ploy, that power ploy that he may pull backstage or anything like that. Let's not forget the first Sting-Hogan match on pay-per-view. It was actually their second match ever in WCW. It was the big Starrcade match, okay? Sting versus Hogan for the World Heavyweight Championship. And Sting had not wrestled a match on television anyway in over a year. I actually got a question in the mailbag from somebody about this. They asking me, you know, was Sting hurt? Is that why he was kept out of action, or what was the deal? No, Sting wasn't hurt, although I'm sure if he had any nagging injuries, you know, over the course of 15 months out of action, he was able to rest up pretty good. It was all part of a storyline that Eric Bischoff had come up with, and he said as part of the storyline that Sting wouldn't be wrestling a match until he got Hogan in the ring. And September of 96 was the very last time we saw Sting with the colored face paint and all that kind of stuff. And he disappeared after that. And then he started reappearing as the Crow and didn't wrestle again until December of 1997. So there was no injury. It was all storyline. And they built that match up, and they went in there, and Hogan and the NWO had just dominated for the entire year. And Hogan had the championship for something like a year and a half or something. And, well, not exactly. I guess Luger beat him for it, and then Hogan got the belt back 6 days later. But the point is, he had dominated the championship scene for like a year and a half in WCW. And this was supposed to be WCW's valiant comeback. Here's their warrior Sting coming to the rescue. They have a match. I'll never forget this match. And that pay-per-view, by the way, was the biggest pay-per-view business WCW ever did. So the promotion to it was great. The execution, not so much. I remember the match. Hogan dominated for like 95% of the match. He beat Sting around. Just beat him up. Made him look like a complete fool. And then comes the spot where Hogan goes for the leg drop, and he nails the leg drop on Sting, goes for the pin, referee Nick Patrick counts the three, and that was it. And I remember watching that for the first time, thinking, what just happened? You know, Hogan goes outside to get the championship. Bret Hart, who had been at the pay-per-view, you know, he had just made his debut in WCW on Nitro maybe 2 weeks earlier, or a week earlier. And he comes out, and he goes over to referee Nick Patrick, and he's saying something about how, you know, I'm not going to let this happen again. Basically, the whole thing is, it was supposed to be a playoff Montreal, where there's a fast count by the referee, and the referee helps screw Sting, so Bret Hart comes out as somebody who knows a thing or two about screw jobs, and this was maybe like a month and a half after Montreal, and Bret punched the referee in the face. And I remember thinking, wow, what a dick. The referee, he claimed a fast count. There was no fast count. You go back and watch that match, Nick Patrick counted the fall like he would have any other. And, anyway, Sting ends up winning the championship. It was a complete cluster. It was a complete botch. And there's still some debate to this day about whether or not Hogan, not that he paid off the referee, but that Hogan went to Nick Patrick before the match and told him to not fast count, or if it was just a mistake by the referee, or obviously something happened. There was some sort of miscommunication or something shady went down. And here we are all these years later now in 2011, Sting and Hogan is main eventing a wrestling pay-per-view. This is the big match that the entire company has been building around, ironically enough, since Hogan came into the company in early 2010. So now, the reason I bring up the WCW match from 97 is not because I'm going on a tangent here. The reason I bring it up is it's kind of eerily ironic that here we are all these years later. Hogan Sting was the big match that one wrestling company, that company being WCW, was banking on way back when. What was that now? 14 years ago. And they built it up for over a year. They built it up for almost a year and a half. And the payoff was underwhelming. And now here we are. Hogan vs. Sting is the focal point of another wrestling promotion, in this case TNA. And this time, the match has essentially been promoted off and on for almost 2 years. So even longer than the first Sting-Hogan match was teased on pay-per-view back in WCW. And here we are heading into Bound for Glory, Hogan versus Sting, and it's going to be very interesting to see what the outcome of this match is. And by the way, that other wrestling company I mentioned, that being WCW, is no longer in business. So, just something to keep in mind here for anybody keeping track. Ring of Honor debuted on Sinclair TV stations this weekend. If there is a Sinclair affiliate in your area, then you are likely able to watch ROH. If you did, by the way, see the Ring of Honor show, send in your feedback, especially if it was your first time watching an ROH show, because I've raved about it before, and I urged everybody last week, if you could, to check out the show. I don't have a Sinclair affiliate. Believe it or not, here in New York City, as far as I know, we do not have a Sinclair station, so I'd have to go on the website to watch ROH, and I tried that last night, and the website was down. Apparently, they're making some cosmetic changes to the site. A fine time, by the way, for them to do that, when you have probably a lot of people who don't have a Sinclair station going on your website to watch the show, and the damn thing is down. That's pretty stupid. So I have not seen the first show yet. I hope to at some point. But they did debut this weekend, and another big piece of Ring of Honor news here that I just wanted to mention, especially if you were planning on attending their big end-of-the-year Final Battle pay-per-view. The show was originally scheduled for Saturday, December 17th, at the Manhattan Center in the Grand Ballroom, which is up on, I believe, the 8th floor. I've seen many Ring of Honor shows in there. The Grand Ballroom, ironically, at the Manhattan Center is the area where WWE used to tape Monday Night Raw back when the show began in 1993. It was in the Grand Ballroom at the Manhattan Center. The Manhattan Center has another venue downstairs called the Hammerstein Ballroom. There's actually multiple venues at the Manhattan Center. And apparently there was a scheduling error on the part of the building. VH1 is going to be taping something upstairs in the ballroom on the 17th. And so the decision has been made to move the Ring of Honor Final Battle show from December 17th, which was a Saturday night, to Friday night, December 23rd, right before Christmas Eve. And they're moving it downstairs to the larger Hammerstein Ballroom. And apparently from now on, going forward, all future Ring of Honor events at the Manhattan Center will take place in the Hammerstein, which is a much better place. It's just a really nice-looking building. The Hammerstein, of course, is where WWE had their ECW one-night stand pay-per-views several years ago. But you could fit up to, I think, 2,500 people or so in the Hammerstein, whereas in the Grand Ballroom, I think maybe you can get up to about 1,200. So right off the bat, you're going to be able to sell more tickets and fit more people in there. And the best part about it, for anybody who has been to Ring of Honor shows in either building, okay, at the Manhattan Center, in either area, I should say, within the Manhattan Center, it's absolutely a plus that people will no longer have to worry about walking up and down 8 freaking flights of stairs. They do have elevators in there, but sometimes the elevator gets full, you don't want to wait, so you decide to take the stairs. 8 flights of stairs. Many a time, I have had to walk up those stairs. Coming down is a lot easier, but going up is no fun. So, no longer will anybody have to worry about that. From now on, all shows on the very first floor in the Hammerstein Ballroom. And anyway, if you have ringside tickets already for the Ring of Honor show, you don't have to worry about doing anything. But if you had balcony tickets to the show, you need to exchange them. And what you need to do is mail the tickets to Ring of Honor, attention, New York City Ticket Return, P.O. Box 1127, Bristol, Pennsylvania 19007. So you put your name, your address, your phone number, and then they can issue you new tickets for the Hammerstein Ballroom. So again, if you have balcony tickets, that's what you need to do in order to exchange them. Otherwise, you're going to pretty much be up Schitt's Creek. Another news bit here. WWE Superstars apparently has been canceled. The online version of Superstars is what aired, quote, aired here in this country. Internationally, the show is going to continue to air, so that will not change. But for those of us here in North America who watch Superstars on WWE.com and on YouTube, apparently they decided to cancel it because of declining viewers. So, in fact, Zack Ryder does get more viewers for his YouTube show than WWE got for Superstars each week, which is rather pathetic when you think about it. Although now the WWE is actually promoting the fact that Zack has a YouTube show, I would expect his hits to go up. But before WWE ever even said a word about Zack Ryder's YouTube show, he was getting hundreds of thousands of hits. So I guess out of sheer embarrassment, WWE decided to cancel Superstars. So there you go. And one last news bit here. CM Punk is on a quest. He's on a quest for ice cream bars. He has a new t-shirt that has an ice cream bar on it. I think it's incredibly dumb. I would not be caught dead wearing that t-shirt. You know, his t-shirt that came out at Money in the Bank, you know, the white one with the fist and all that, the ringer tee, I think that's a pretty cool-looking t-shirt. I saw it in the store a couple weeks ago. It was actually in a store in the mall. They had a bunch of WWE shirts. They had, the C-Nation shirt and the Rock Brahma Bull shirt and Rey Mysterio and all this stuff. And I thought about it. I figured, you know what? It's a good-looking shirt. If they're selling the shirt at a discounted price, I might actually pick this up. And then I looked at the price tag, and it was exactly what you would have paid for it on WWE Shop, and I said, not going to happen. This shirt, it's a picture of a freaking ice cream bar on the front of the shirt. Now, I think this whole campaign is cute, and I would love to see the WWE ice cream bars back. I really do. I respect CM Punk's love of ice cream. Hell, I'm lactose intolerant. I can't even have ice cream anymore the way that I used to, but I would still love to see the WWE ice cream bars back. But really, who thought that was a good idea for a t-shirt? I mean, come on. Really, would you want to go out wearing that shirt? Come on. Anyway, as reported on SE Scoops, CM Punk's quest to resurrect WWE's beloved ice cream bars is still going on. He's not giving up all hope just yet. Punk did an interview with the WWE website, talked about the new t-shirt I just talked about, which he wore at the Night of Champions pay-per-view. Maybe that's why he lost. It was bad luck. Maybe it was, actually. You know, he wore that new shirt, the white shirt, at Money in the Bank, and he won. He wore the shirt at SummerSlam, and he won before he lost. He wore the new shirt at Night of Champions and just got beat by Triple H, so maybe he has to go back to the other shirt. But anyway, Punk says he wants the freaking ice cream bars back. He says he's still working on that. He says there's other ice cream companies out there. If Good Humor does not want to do it, they'll just go find somebody else willing to make the ice cream bars. He says he loves ice cream. What can I say? I am a skinny, fat ass. And on Twitter on Wednesday, Punk actually wrote, "My day of hustling is over. Many steps were taken to get ice cream bars. Now it's gym time. The future is bright and tastes like vanilla." So before long, we may see the old WWE ice cream bars back. And when I say old, I don't even want the new guys on the ice cream bars, okay? If they come back with them, I don't want to see CM Punk and John Cena and Randy Orton on an ice cream bar, okay? I want to see the old bars brought back. I want Hogan, Savage, Jake the Snake, LOD. That's what I want. On last week's show, I pitched the idea that one of our listeners wrote in with about devoting a couple of minutes on a sound-off episode, maybe not every week, but maybe every other week or a few times a month, where you guys pick a classic match, whatever your definition of classic is, and I will watch the match, and I will review it. I will talk about it on the sound-off, give the backstory to it, give my thoughts and impressions on a match that, you know, however old it may be. Maybe it's a more recent match. I think it would be more fun to do matches that were at least 10 years old, but whatever you guys are interested in. I already had a bunch of people write into me and make suggestions, and there were actually four matches that came up a couple of different times from a couple of different people. So I'm going to list the four matches here, and you guys let me know which of these matches you think would be worthy of being talked about and reviewed here on the Sound Off. We've got Bret Hart against Steve Austin at WrestleMania 13. I got a lot of requests for that one. Got a couple for the very first Hell in a Cell at Bad Blood between Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. Rock vs. Triple H at Backlash in 2000, which was a fantastic... it was just a great match in terms of everything that happened. There was just so much going on. It was just great stuff. And then Shawn Michaels and Chris Jericho at WrestleMania 19, a match that I have not seen probably since WrestleMania 19. But I got a couple of people who asked about that. So, you know, let me know what you think of those matches. If you have any other matches you want to suggest, that's fine too. But if any of the matches I just mentioned tickles your fancy, let me know. And perhaps sometime in the next couple of weeks, we will do that. We will devote some time to that here on the Sound Off. I also heard from a bunch of people who said they would totally be into the idea of buying a Sound Off t-shirt if they were actually made. And so I just want to hear from some more of you. Is that something that you would potentially be interested in, a Sound Off t-shirt? I don't know what would be on it exactly, but again, write in, let me know what you think. And if there's enough support for it, perhaps there will be a t-shirt in the works. Let's dive into the mailbag here. Got a lot of good questions and some shout-outs to get to here this week. As always, if you have a question, comment, or anything else, you can email me directly at thesolomonster@gmail.com. Still the only way, the best way to possibly get something read on the air. You can send me all the Facebook messages you want, and I may or may not respond, but if you want something on the air, you got to email me. Just like Jagger did. Jagger writes in, he says, "Dear Solomonster, what would WWE be like if John Cena had never been signed by the company? I'm from Waynesboro, Tennessee. Keep up the good work." Well, if John Cena had never gotten signed by WWE, or if he would have gotten cut, which he came very close to being cut before he got noticed by Stephanie McMahon doing the Vanilla Ice gimmick on that, I think it was Halloween edition of SmackDown, there would just be somebody else in the John Cena role. In fact, I think Randy Orton would probably be the one kissing babies and saluting like the Marine. Saeed from Danbury, Connecticut writes in. He's actually celebrating a birthday on September 30th and wanted to get a shout-out here on the show. So happy birthday, Saeed. I hope I'm saying that right. He is a part of the Triple Threat, even though he hates Twitter. Still a member of the Triple Threat. That's dedication right there. See, so even those of you who dislike Twitter, and I totally understand why, you've got no excuse. If this guy's part of the Triple Threat, then why not you? Speaking of birthdays, Jacob from Wichita, Kansas is going to be celebrating one on September 27th and desperately wanted a shout-out here on the Sound Off. So happy birthday, Jacob. Hope everything goes well on your birthday. He has gone back since he's become a listener and listened to every episode available. So he is a Sound Off fanatic. In fact, you can do a Google search. It's not very difficult for some of the old shows on TalkShoe. Of course, we're hosted now through Podbean. TalkShoe is the name of the company that I used to do the hosting with for the shows. And there are Sound Offs that go all the way back to episode 43, still available online if you search hard enough. So if you're like Jacob, you can go back and listen to all of that goodness, including some of my more memorable shows. I did a two-part show for episode 65, if I remember correctly. It was the an hour-long WrestleMania 25 review, which included one of the greatest matches I've ever seen between Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker, and then an entirely separate podcast as hour number two, the infamous Michael Jackson rant from episode 75, and a whole bunch of other good ones. So if you're like Jacob, you can go back and check out all those old shows. Corey writes in, "With Hulk Hogan's TNA contract expiring soon, what are the odds that we'll see him in a WWE ring again? Obviously, the man is in no shape to wrestle, but perhaps in some sort of ambassador role or something along those lines. I would say that the chances of that happening are better than 95%. I fully expect to see Hulk Hogan back in the good graces of WWE at some point. As you said, hopefully not wrestling. He can show up at a WrestleMania show at some point, get a big pop and all that, and it's going to happen. Whether or not you want it to happen, I know some people would be perfectly content if they never see Hogan's face on a wrestling show ever again. And God knows Hogan has had many comebacks, and he's gotten many memorable reactions from the crowd. If Hulk Hogan, God forbid, died tomorrow, his legacy in the last couple of years leaves a lot to be desired. His name has been dragged through the mud. He's been through a divorce, a lot of different family issues and back issues and all that stuff. But Hogan will be very fondly remembered by all of his old fans and much of the wrestling audience. And, he had a great career, but I don't think we've seen the last of him in WWE. Nissim writes into the show. He, too, was seemingly disgusted by the outcome of Night of Champions, at least in the championship match. He has an interesting proposal here. After seeing the WWE Championship desecrated once again after Cena won it for the millionth time, he says, I came up with an idea. Cena is good business since kids and women love him and men love to hate him. Let's rename the WWE Championship to the WWE Kids Championship and maybe have Nickelodeon sponsor it, thus making more profit off of it. I felt like vomiting after seeing Kelly and Cena winning again. I'm glad WWE dropped its association to wrestling. Whatever Kelly did, it was not wrestling. Anyway, I'm sure Cena would get stuck in the low to mid-card had he wrestled during the Attitude Era. You know, that's a very interesting question there. If John Cena were around in WWE during the Attitude Era, in like 1998, 1999, 2000, what position do you think he would be in on the card? I don't even know that I have an answer to that. I mean, we could certainly sit here and guess. You know, like in this case, Nissim seems to think that he would be mid-card at best, which is probably a pretty good guess. But, maybe Cena would have worked as a very effective heel. Again, when Cena came into WWE, he was a heel. Well, he was a face, I guess. But then he went heel. He had the white boy thugonomics gimmick. That gimmick, I think, would have worked in the Attitude Era. I mean, you would have had guys like Rock and Steve Austin completely make fun of him and just tear him down. But I could see that version of John Cena with hopefully a little more experience in the ring in a program with The Rock, for example, back then. So I tend to think that whether it's as a heel or a face, Cena, I give him a little more credit than that. I think he would have been pushed as something special even then. Certainly not the face of the company. But I think he would have done actually quite well for himself during the Attitude Era. Certainly not in this gimmick, though. Kirk from Texas is actually writing in because he's quite upset that the new Nexus has been forgotten. He wanted my thoughts on the new Nexus being forgotten as CM Punk's group amidst all the madness that's been going on with Triple H. He says all of a sudden there's no more new Nexus. Vince could have possibly used them later in the storyline to help battle Nash and others or have them actually turn on Punk. I know they are pretty dull and their personality isn't cult-like, but come on. In my opinion, Vince dropped the ball on this. Well, I disagree. Obviously, WWE, they just completely forgot about the new Nexus. It's true. They never bothered to explain the fact that the group has apparently gone their separate ways, and they could have done a much better job of explaining that. But the new Nexus sucked, okay? The original Nexus had a lot of promise. The core on SmackDown, which was comprised of some members of the original Nexus, were a decent little group. They weren't anything special. The new Nexus sucked, and it was below CM Punk. If anything, it was bringing CM Punk down. And I'm very happy that CM Punk has completely dissociated himself from the new Nexus. You know, Otunga, you know my thoughts on David Otunga. Okay, the guy's got a good look, and that's all he has. He showed some promise to me here and there. He guest hosted Raw early on when they started the concept. He impressed me, and ever since then, it has all been downhill. And whether it's his fault, if it's WWE's fault, it's a combination, because Otunga just isn't that good. But it's also the fact that WWE tried shoving him down our throat so much that you start to turn against the guy, kind of like John Cena. And to see other people get overlooked, I guess would be the best word, when people like Otunga have had a lot of opportunities. Until now. I think now they've come to their senses. They call him boring on commentary every week. And all of a sudden they seem to be talking more and more about his wife. Or at least last week they were bringing up Jennifer Hudson, the fact that he's married to Jennifer Hudson. She's such a big celebrity, and he's riding her coattails. They were really, really dragging his name through the mud, which makes me think Otunga's days in WWE could very well be numbered. But Joe Hennig, he's got a lot of promise. I've only seen so much of him in WWE that's impressed me. For the most part, he's been, you know, part of this Nexus group, and they gave him that stupid name, and he just hasn't been able to shine through. When he was in developmental, I heard pretty good things about him. I haven't really seen him reach that potential on television, so I think there's something there. You have to at least give the guy a chance. His pedigree is such that he deserves a chance. You cannot be the son of Mr. Perfect and be complete shit. I don't think that he is complete shit. I think he's got a lot more promise and upside than David Otunga. And then the other member of the new Nexus that's forgotten about is Mason Ryan, who of course suffered an injury. He was off television for many, many months. In fact, he still has not made a return to Raw. He is back in action. As a matter of fact, I think he had a match on Superstars or something. There was a JPEG image floating around on the internet that I posted on Twitter over the weekend. And again, if you're not following on Twitter, get on there and follow. I saw Mason Ryan in this picture. This is the first time I've seen him since he came back from his injury. What the fuck is going on with this guy's hair? Can somebody explain that to me? It's like a living organism all on its own. It's like a giant rat sitting on top of his head like a mop or something. I don't know what the fuck that thing is. I was just completely frightened when I saw a picture of this. You know, if they were trying to build Mason Ryan up as some kind of monster before, then they have completely abandoned that idea. And I will say this, when Mason Ryan was on TV the first time, even then I thought his hair was a little weird. Like, he had it parted, it was very, I don't know, Mason Ryan's the kind of guy that would benefit from just shaving his head. You know what I mean? Some guys, that look just works. You know, Dave Bautista, he's another, everyone calls Mason Ryan a Bautista clone, and I see a lot of the similarities there. Bautista used to have a little bit of hair on his head, and then eventually he shaved it off, or he had a little bit of stubble. That would be the look, I think, that would work for Mason Ryan. So even his hair before, which was more normal, was not that good. But this monstrosity here, I don't know what kind of look he's going for. I think I made the comment on Twitter, he looks like a game show host straight out of the 1970s. My God. I mean, if that's the reason that they broke CM Punk away from Mason Ryan, then boy, did they make the right move. Go take a look at that picture on Twitter that I posted. Or if any of you have been watching Superstars or wherever that picture was from, it looked like it was from a match on Superstars. Go take a look at that, okay? And then get back to me. Okay, Kirk, go take a look at that picture, and then you tell me how upset you are that the new Nexus disintegrated and they got CM Punk away from Mason Ryan. What a shitty hairdo. My God. Lee from Manchester, England writes in, it was around this time 12 years ago, I wouldn't mind you reviewing, the six-pack challenge for the WWE Championship from Unforgiven 1999. The same show featured the infamous Kennel from Hell match featuring Al Snow and the Big Boss Man, which in my humble opinion is one of the best matches in history, up there with Batista vs. Kali and the Punjabi prison match. I'll tell you what, I might be more apt to want to review that Kennel from Hell match because of how awful it was. It's been a long time since I've seen that match. I just remember the whole point of it was, you know, you've got the old school kind of blue bar, although I guess it was black, WWF style steel cage, surrounded by a Hell in a Cell. It's topped off by a Hell in a Cell. And in between the two cages, in between the Hell in a Cell and the ring, you've got these dog handlers with all these dogs, and they're supposed to be really vicious, and I just remember that all the dogs were, like, peeing on the floor, like, huddled in one corner. It was just, everything about that match was just a fail. But I feel like it would be rather entertaining to go back and review that. So perhaps if there's enough support for that idea, I might actually consider it. Matthew writes into the Sound Off, I get the two top titles confused, as I've heard you do also, as and it gets changed so many times. But I know Booker T has won the World Heavyweight Championship and now Mark Henry, but as an African-American, has an African-American won the WWE title at all? Or are these two superstars in a class of their own? They are indeed in a class of their own in WWE. I mean, you can go back if you want to take a look at WCW when Ron Simmons won the championship back in 92 and all that. But in WWE, there has never been a what you would call proper African-American superstar. I mean, a lot of people complain, oh, The Rock is not really black, so he doesn't count. Well, technically, The Rock does count because he is part African-American, but if somebody is looking for someone like a Mark Henry or you know, a Bobby Lashley or a Booker T, then no. No black man has ever won the WWE Championship before. They have won the World Heavyweight title. Henry and Booker T are in very tight company, very elite company in that respect. Bobby Lashley at one point was looked at as kind of the future of WWE. And If he would have stuck around, to me, he probably would have been the first to win the WWE Championship. But things didn't work out, and there were some issues. He left the company. He went into mixed martial arts, and the rest is kind of history, as they say. But interestingly enough, I mean, we haven't had a proper, you know, black WWE champion, but we've had a, you know, the first Irish-born superstar winning the championship, and now with Alberto Del Rio, the first Mexican superstar to win the championship. So I think it'll happen. I think it'll happen soon enough. I was going to say Eddie Guerrero, but Eddie Guerrero was technically a Mexican-American. So, you know, Alberto, that was something special, having been born in Mexico and then winning the championship, although they took the freaking title off him 1 month later, so much for that. Got another letter here. I've been watching Stone Cold segments lately, trying to find the best. I remember watching his speech after his King of the Ring victory over Jake Roberts. Also, him pissing on something live on Raw around 2002 or so. My favorite is the time that he gathered the entire alliance around the ring after he joined them and took leadership and berated them, eventually starting the what chant after whatting RVD, I believe it was, or maybe it was Raven. What is your favorite Steve Austin segment? Well, I guarantee you it wasn't that one. Goddamn what chant. But my favorite Steve Austin segment probably is still from Raw in September of 1998. It would have been the night after the Breakdown pay-per-view when Austin lost the championship. He was in that triple threat with Kane and Undertaker, and they've kind of both pinned him simultaneously, so there was some controversy about who exactly was the champion. But Vince McMahon, he had screwed Austin. He was on Raw the next night with the title in a trophy case in the ring. They had the red carpet rolled out. They were going to have a ceremony where they announced the new champion, and Austin, who I guess had been barred from the building, came barreling through on a Zamboni, and he rode the Zamboni into the building. He knocked out a light pole. He came down the aisleway with it, literally crashed into the ring, climbed up on top of the Zamboni, and then attacked Vince McMahon. It was absolute chaos and pandemonium. The crowd, I've never seen a crowd go apeshit like this on Raw in my life. It was so much fun to watch. That probably is my favorite Steve Austin segment of many. I mean, if I go back through them, I'm sure I could find many others. Gary writes in, on Raw, I noticed the announcers referencing something known as the tag rope during the main event. I've never noticed it before. What exactly is the significance of the tag rope, and how long has it been in effect? Tag rope has been around, I think, for decades. It's one of those old-school wrestling gimmicks. And basically, the premise of it is, when you're in a tag team match, you're supposed to stay in your corner on the apron. Otherwise, you can pretty much walk around the apron and stand wherever you want to. So the purpose of the tag rope is, while you're outside on the apron, at all times, you need to have one hand tied down to or holding the tag rope so that you are kept in your proper corner. And I believe WWE had done away with it for many years, maybe around the Attitude Era or a little bit after that, because I don't remember seeing the tag rope, or at least if it was there, it wasn't really used. In the last couple of years, maybe the last 5 years or so, I've noticed the tag rope make a return, or at the very least, they've made mention of it on TV. It's been more noticeable. You see tag team wrestlers actually making use of it during matches, which I think is kind of cool. It's just one of those old-school wrestling gimmicks that you could do without it. I mean, it's not a huge deal or anything like that, but the fact that they still honor that, I think, when they honor very few other traditions these days, is very cool. But yes, it's been around for many, many years. I believe it was gone for a while, and then they brought it back. Michael Avila writes in, he has a question. Why do you suppose Brutus Beefcake was never given a big push in the late 80s WWF days? Seeing that he was good friends with Hulk Hogan, I figured Hogan would have wanted to keep his friends in the top tier of talent. Back then, I remember two times he was scheduled to win the Intercontinental Championship. He was taken out, the last one against Mr. Perfect because of the parasailing accident. Was Hogan that selfish? I got to be honest with you, I have no idea what you're talking about here. To me, Beefcake was overpushed when he was in WWF, and it was exactly because he was friends with Hulk Hogan. The two of them were friends, I think, going back to the 70s. And, you know, Beefcake, to me, he got over with the barber gimmick, but he probably would have been gone a lot quicker than he was were it not for Hulk Hogan. You know, Hogan did plenty for Beefcake. Just because he was friends with him doesn't mean that they were going to put the world championship on the guy. But, you know, you mentioned the two times he was scheduled to win the Intercontinental title, which is true. There were two different occasions when Brutus Beefcake was supposed to become the Intercontinental champion. And the first time, I believe, he was supposed to beat Honky Tonk Man, if I remember correctly. And that was the plan. And as a matter of fact, I believe the match had been scheduled for SummerSlam in 88 at the Garden. It was going to be Beefcake against Honky Tonk Man, and then Beefcake got hurt. And that's when they came up with the Ultimate Warrior as the last-minute replacement. 30 seconds later, boom, he's the new champion. And in one night, they made a star. I believe it was a legit injury that Beefcake suffered, you know, heading into that match, which is why it had to be changed. The second time, as you mentioned, he was supposed to win the Intercontinental Championship from, I believe, Mr. Perfect. This would have been in 1990, maybe 91, but I think it was 90. And he had the parasailing accident. He was on a boat. And I, if I remember correctly, it was a situation where, I don't know exactly what happened, but he got hit in the face, I think. He got kicked in the face, I think, by somebody on the boat. They're like barefoot, kicked him in the face or something. And whatever happened, his face was just shattered into a million pieces. And he had to undergo just multiple hours of surgery, this really long surgical operation. They put plates in his face. I mean, that was all legit. That was not just for a storyline. And it was just a bad twist of fate for him, essentially. It's just, in a way, it's what happened. You know, he got hurt both times. That's the only reason. Otherwise, Brutus Beefcake would now be a former Intercontinental Champion. And you mentioned that, you know, he was never really prominently featured or in any main events. Again, that's a lie, because, as a matter of fact, Beefcake was in the pay-per-view main event at SummerSlam 89. He was in a tag team match. It was Hulk Hogan, who, again, think about this. Hulk Hogan was the biggest star in the business at the time, okay? Brutus Beefcake was getting over with his barber act, but he was not a main event guy at all. Nobody looked at him as a main event guy. He was an upper mid-card guy at best. And yet, Beefcake was in the SummerSlam main event teaming up with the biggest star in the company, teaming up with the WWE champion against Randy Savage and Zeus. Why do you think that was? I'm sure Hogan had a little something to do with that. As a matter of fact, they had another tag team match with the two teams that was taped for a pay-per-view special. And it ended up on one of their home videos. It was a tag team cage match. And again, it was Hogan and Beefcake against Zeus and Savage. WrestleMania 9. Hulk Hogan had been out of the company for a year. He was making his big comeback at WrestleMania. And it was in a tag team match. It was Hulk Hogan teaming with Brutus the Barber Beefcake against Money Incorporated for the tag team titles. That's a pretty high-profile, prominent position for Beefcake to be in. So to insinuate that Beefcake was never pushed, that Hogan held him back, why didn't they do more with him? They did plenty with Beefcake, and if anything, they did way too much. Beefcake was over-pushed by WWE for his talent. He was a fine wrestler. He wasn't awful or anything like that. I mean, you see some of the guys they bring up these days. It makes Brutus Beefcake look like the second coming of Luthez, for Christ's sake. But he wasn't anything overly special. On promos, I thought, quite frankly, that he wasn't very good. If you go back and listen to him hosting those barbershop segments, he's stumbling over his words, and it was one of the weaker points, I think, of his entire act, was him speaking on the mic. So I think Beefcake should thank his lucky stars, quite frankly, that he got the kind of push he did. And then in WCW, when Hogan went over there, Beefcake had a job for life. You know, Beefcake came over with him. Guys like Beefcake and Jim Duggan and Brian Knobbs, all friends of Hogan, they all got jobs. And Beefcake played at least five different characters in his time with WCW. You know, the Zodiac and the Booty Man and the Butcher and the Disciple and maybe one other one. And he can thank Hulk Hogan for all of that. Brian Perez from Queens, New York writes in. He's celebrating a birthday tomorrow, actually, on September 26th. I wanted to know if I can give him a birthday shout-out. He's turning 18, so happy birthday to Brian, 18. Now you can vote. It's a very important age. Not as fun as 21, but 18 is still one of those milestone birthdays. So, happy birthday, Brian. Thomas has a question. Do you think Dolph Ziggler would do well turning face? No, I don't, actually. Not at this point. Maybe in 2 years, maybe ask me that same question. Dolph Ziggler is a heel. He's actually quite good. But like I talked about a little bit earlier on in the show today, you're only going to get over if WWE gives you a chance to get over. And he's getting more mic time. He's doing whatever he's doing with Vicky. Vicky is like a heat magnet, although I think she's cooled off a little bit since her heyday running SmackDown. But they put Dolph and Vicky together to try to help get Dolph over, and that's a noble idea. But to me, whatever Dolph is doing right now, it's not working. Although I will say they put him with Hugh Jackman on Raw, even though he got punched in the face and he lost. We should see more of that. I think Dolph should be rubbing elbows with some of the higher profile guys in the company, because I think he could be something special. But as a babyface, I think to him right now, that would be the kiss of death. And the other part of Thomas's question here, if Eric Bischoff and Hulk Hogan do not re-sign a new contract with TNA, do you think Paul Heyman would be a good replacement? And if that isn't the case, who would replace them on TV? I don't think Hogan and Bischoff have to be replaced on TV. Why do you have to replace both of them? Just get rid of them and utilize the guys you have under contract. As far as Paul Heyman taking over, yes, in theory, Paul Heyman, I think, could do a lot more than Eric Bischoff has done or Hulk Hogan has done to try to turn TNA around. I don't know if TNA is salvageable at this point. I don't even know if the great Paul Heyman, with all of his creative, wonderful ideas, can save TNA. I honestly, at this point, I don't know if he can do it. I think you'd have to just completely change everything. The name, the logo, just completely absolve yourself from having anything to do with TNA. Just create a completely new company and get the hell out of Orlando. Then maybe it would work. But, you know, the likelihood of Heyman coming in, that ship has sailed. They could have had Paul Heyman. Paul Heyman has said that they could have had Paul Heyman. And you can blame Dixie Carter for the reason that that did not happen. Daryl from Windsor, Ontario, Canada, has two questions. First one, has there been any news on the Santino Marella automobile accident? What is his condition since the accident? I have not heard anything since then, and I don't believe he has been on TV since. He has not been on television. As far as I know, last I read, he was still convalescing and should be ready to come back to TV very, very soon. In fact, maybe within the next week or two. So we'll see if he pops up on there. Second question here, do you believe there is a chance for The Undertaker to come back at Survivor Series? Maybe it's just me, but it seems like he would either return or disappear traditionally at that pay-per-view. If he were to come back, who do you think he would go into a feud with? It's too early to tell if we're talking about WrestleMania. If Undertaker came back at Survivor Series for one feud before WrestleMania, then I'm okay with doing the Mark Henry feud. I just don't think Undertaker and Mark Henry, for Undertaker's, you know, quest to go 20-0, I don't think that's a high-profile enough match. But it's a moot point because I don't see Undertaker coming back at Survivor Series. I mean, maybe they'll start running videos, the lights will flicker. Last I heard, and Jim Ross has even commented about this on Twitter and in his blog, I don't see Undertaker back until early next year, right around WrestleMania time. There's really no reason to bring him back before then. Although, look, if he came back at Survivor Series, I'd be happy. I'm going to be there. You get no complaints out of me. There's nothing like an Undertaker entrance. It really isn't. Brandon Mobley writes in, do you believe that Alberto Del Rio losing the championship to John Cena was done so that he could win it back live on Raw next month in Mexico City? Perhaps it was, but it doesn't make it any better, you know? I wish they would stop using the fucking belt as a prop. You know, you don't just take the championship off a guy and say, well, we'll take it off him now so we can put it back on him in 3 weeks when we're in Mexico. Really? That's a really good reason to take a championship belt off somebody. If that were the case, then why put the title on Del Rio at SummerSlam? Why not just have Cena beat Punk? Cena's your champion, since you obviously want him to be champion. And then when Raw comes to Mexico, Del Rio cashes in and gets his big victory. Why not do that? Does that not make more sense? Are they worried that he's going to get a babyface reaction if they do that? He's going to get a babyface reaction anyway if people are into him. And if they're not, he'll get booed. It's not going to matter whether he's there winning the championship or defending the damn thing. Second question here from Brandon. When this Sin Cara versus Sin Cara feud is over, do you see WWE keeping a main spot on the roster for Hunico? I assume the WWE wants more than one masked wrestler on their roster, but do you believe that if and when Rey Mysterio comes back, he will be sent back to FCW? I hope not. Hunico's been down in FCW, where he was, for a long-ass time. And he finally got a shot. You know, granted, it was extenuating circumstances, but he finally gets brought up to the main roster, and if he just gets sent right back down, that's a pretty shitty thing to do to a guy. But, you know, is there going to be a spot for him? Hey, there's always a spot for new talent. Hunico, maybe without the mask, you know, I could see them doing a Sin Cara match in Mexico City next month. And they could even do a mask match, maybe, you know, because the real Sin Cara is not losing his mask, but the other guy is the fake. We've already established that there's a real Sin Cara and a fake Sin Cara. So you would think that to end this feud, one person would lose their mask. So if Hunico loses the mask, then he can have a completely different gimmick and maybe move him over to the Raw roster. Sure, I don't see why not. I think the guy deserves a shot. He's done a fine job. I still think, you know, you can't really compare him. It's not fair to compare him to Mystico. Mystico is such a better, more exciting, high-flying performer. You know, Hunico's a little bit bigger. He's not quite as fluid and as, I guess, captivating, for lack of a better term, than Mystico is in the ring. So it's very unfair to compare. But he's a great performer, and he deserves a shot. Sure, I say keep a spot open for him. Absolutely. Steve from New Jersey, what is your opinion about the Muppets being the guest hosts of the October 31st Raw? I think it is a complete joke and a waste of time. I don't really care. We can make fun of it. It is what it is. Don't get all bent out of shape. If anything, it actually could turn out to be funny. I just wonder what's going to happen if they actually want to bring them out to the ring. Are we going to see the puppeteer? That would kind of kill the act. I would guess they're just going to limit them to backstage segments. And perhaps, I'll tell you what I could see them doing. I could see them bringing the Muppets out during a commercial break. And we come back from commercial, and the Muppets are at ringside to do color commentary with Michael Cole. And the puppeteers are underneath the announce desk, which, again, kills the illusion for the people in the building if you're in the front row by the announcers and you can see. But for the television viewing audience, you know, you just kind of come back after a commercial break. There are the Muppets kind of propped up over the announce table doing commentary. I'll tell you what, they probably do better job at commentary than Michael Cole would. So I actually wouldn't mind that at all. Let's get a campaign going. Kermit the Frog to replace Michael Cole. Kermit the Frog, I think, actually sounds less annoying than Michael Cole, which is quite an accomplishment there. Alex from Chicago writes in, his question is regarding WWE's attendance figures at pay-per-views. Every time I go back and look at a WWE attendance number for a pay-per-view over the last 8 to 10 years, I've noticed you see numbers like 10,000, 8,000, and my personal favorite of 3,500 for the infamous Taboo Tuesday back in Milwaukee in 2004. Is the reason for these low attendance figures due to poor ticket sales or because WWE only wants a certain amount of tickets sold? It seems as if New York, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, Buffalo, Chicago, and any city in Canada are the only cities that seem to sell out regularly. Buffalo? Are you sure that Buffalo sells out regularly? It's kind of weird if they do, but okay. Because of WWE wanting only a certain number of tickets sold, that doesn't make any sense. Believe me, WWE did not want 3,500 people for Taboo Tuesday. The fact is, there are certain markets that are stronger wrestling markets. New York, traditionally, has always been a great market. Any city in Canada? I wouldn't say any city, but Toronto, Montreal, what's the other one? Quebec is Montreal, but they always do well up there. Philly, L.A., Chicago is another good one. You're from Chicago, so I'm sure you're well aware of that. There are certain markets that are just simply stronger than others. And they have greater populations in some cases than other states might. Milwaukee traditionally was a very strong wrestling city. There's a lot of wrestling history, a lot of wrestling lineage in the city of Milwaukee. And unfortunately, in 2011, a lot of those older fans have been chased off. You cannot always expect to go into a place like Milwaukee and sell out because wrestling was traditionally a wrestling stronghold. Again, WWE, for all the good they do, they also do a lot to kill off tradition with their current product. It's just a matter of they're not giving a compelling enough product, so therefore some cities it's very difficult. You have to give away a lot of freebies, a lot of comp tickets, and then you have a situation like a TNA. You know, TNA's finally starting to go on the road, and they've had tapings now from Knoxville, and then it was Fayetteville earlier in the year, and supposedly, I mean, at the end of the day, there's a lot of walk-up, and they edit it, and they tarp off enough areas to where it looks pretty good on TV, but they can't sell tickets worth shit when they go out on the road. Why? Because either people don't know about TNA, they do a piss-poor job of advertising, or people see the product on TV, and they think, why the fuck would I want to go watch that? If you give people a reason to want to go to your show, then the people will come. That's really what it boils down to. He also says that he's noticed many listeners writing in about their experience at Money in the Bank. Alex was in attendance for that show as well, and he said it is the best sporting and entertainment event I have ever been to. The crowd was insane, and any John Cena fan was just eaten alive. CM Punk was the king of Illinois for that night. But what I was really surprised with was a reaction Randy Orton got during his match with Christian, which was 50-50. But when he gave Christian the RKO on the table after the match and went back for a second time, it was one of the loudest pops and sounds I have ever heard in person. That whole pay-per-view was insane. There's nothing like a Chicago crowd. So that comes from Alex. Luis from Illinois says, do you think Kofi Kingston's racist shirt could be a problem for Linda McMahon's political campaign? I have no idea what you're talking about. Perhaps it would help if I saw a picture of this supposedly racist t-shirt. I know nothing of this. Francisco writes in, this is a sweet email here, he says his mom is a big wrestling fan and it's her birthday. Today, I believe. So, happy birthday to Mary Luz Rodriguez. Hopefully I pronounced that correctly. It's a fine birthday gift, I think, from a son to his mom. This question comes from Christopher. Has three questions. First off, can you give me a birthday shout-out? Me and my twin brother Christian, not that one, are about to celebrate our 21st birthday on Monday. So happy birthday to, I guess, Chris and Chris, we can say. He says, my second question is, what did you do on your 21st birthday? Well, I would tell you what I did on my 21st birthday, but I don't remember. Last question is in regards to WrestleMania. Why is it that back in the day, WrestleMania 7, for example, there were 13 to 15 matches total on the show, and now we have like 7 or 8 matches that last only 5 or 10 minutes. Well, I don't think they last quite that short. Anyway, he's always wondered how they were able to fit 13 matches on one card without it getting boring or pressed for time. Have you seen any of those undercards on the early WrestleManias? You claim that they were able to do that without it getting boring, and I would argue that if that was their goal, they failed. I look back fondly from a nostalgic point of view on a lot of those early WrestleMania shows, but go back and watch some of the undercard matches on those shows. They were definitely pressed for time in some cases, and they were not exactly the most thrilling bouts that you will ever see in your lifetime. It was a situation where they wanted to try to get as many people on the show as possible. You know, there's the payoff issue also. People want to be on WrestleMania because it means something to their wallet. And oftentimes they would stick guys together without any rhyme or reason just to get them on the show. And back then you also had less in the way of entertainment. So on a given WrestleMania show, you would have some backstage interviews. You might have even a skit. But you didn't have skits the way that we have skits today. You know, I mean, you watch a WWE pay-per-view in 2011, you're getting backstage skits, you're getting the build-up videos, which you did not have videos like that back then. The extent to which the big matches would get some sort of preview is that they would show footage from an angle, let's say, that happened on Superstars, or something to that effect. You didn't have this 3 or 4 minute or 5 minute long video package, these elaborate videos that they have these days, which eat time from the pay-per-view. But you also had less backstage bullshit back then and all of that sort of thing. And the other thing about current pay-per-views that you have that you didn't back then were fucking commercials. They actually have commercials now on their pay-per-view shows. Even if they're WWE themed, I think that's completely unacceptable. You know, I'm paying X number of dollars for a pay-per-view, and it's one thing if you're going to run a quick ad for your next pay-per-view or a quick ad saying tune into Raw tomorrow night. But now I have to watch an ad for your sponsor, so you've got Snickers, and then they'll run one for SummerSlam, and then they'll run one for something else, or a video game, or a movie. I think they had a movie commercial recently on one of their pay-per-views. Complete and total horseshit. You didn't have that back then. You had more time, and therefore you could put more matches on the show. As far as the way they do things now, I actually think it's a lot better the way they do things now in terms of the total number of matches. Ideally, on a 3-hour wrestling pay-per-view, which is really only 2 hours and like 45 minutes, sometimes they go longer than that, I think having a total of 6 to 8 matches max is perfect for a show like that. WrestleMania, you can go a little bit more because you have the extra hour. And again, it's WrestleMania. You want to get as many people on the show as possible. So I actually like the way they do it these days. I think 13 matches on any wrestling card is completely ridiculous. And again, when you do that, yes, there are going to be matches that are rushed in 3 or 4 minutes' time. So that's the reason they used to do it and the way they do things now. So that's going to do it for the mailbag this week. That was a monster mailbag there. Got a lot of questions out of the way, and there's still some I wasn't able to get to. I hope to get to those at some point, either directly or on the show. If you've sent me questions before, some people tend to do this, don't resend me the same question another 1 or 2 times in case I didn't see it. On occasion, some emails do get sucked up in the spam filter. I will catch it sometimes. Sometimes I don't. But by and large, when you email me something, I get it. I see it. You don't have to email me the same thing 3 or 4 times. That just makes me angry. And I'm less apt to answer your question if you do that. So there were a couple of people doing that. Don't. But you can still email me your questions, comments, suggestions, and the like to thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. Become part of the Triple Threat. The Triple Threat is an elite group here as part of this Sound Off crew. And you are officially part of the Triple Threat if you follow me on Twitter, @Solemnmonster. You can friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/thesolemnmonster. God, I sound like Zack Ryder now. And you can subscribe to this channel on YouTube. No, I'm kidding. You can subscribe to this show in iTunes for free. Type in Solemnmonster Sounds Off and click subscribe or whatever, however it works. And anytime a new show, whether it's a new show or maybe just a new vintage show from the past that I sometimes will put up, it will automatically be downloaded for you. You will be plugged in, and you will never, ever miss an episode of The Sound Off. Doesn't get any better than that. If you are part of Twitter, Facebook, and iTunes, you are officially in the Triple Threat. And if you download the show directly from SEScoops.com, which is also another avenue you could take, I guess you're part of the Fatal 4-Way. But that's not an official group. And so, yeah, anyway, get on all that stuff. Friend me, follow me, and all that good stuff. And again, I am planning on doing an interview with somebody later this week, probably on Thursday. We're going to try to get it done then, but his schedule is a little bit busy of late. And we'll see how that goes. If you follow me on Twitter, you already pretty much know who it is. I'm not going to comment otherwise. And if all goes well, that interview could be part of the very next Sound Off. If not that one, then the one after that. I'm really looking forward to it. He's a fascinating individual, somebody who I've become friends with recently, and I think it'll be a very enjoyable interview if I'm able to pull it off. And I've got some other plans for some fun Sound Off-related stuff coming up in the weeks and months ahead. So a lot of good things on the horizon. Again, there will probably not be a show next Sunday, but I'm hoping to do one a day or two earlier. And so 181 should be here next week. I'll keep everybody abreast. I love that word. I'll keep everybody abreast. Sounds so lewd. I'll keep everybody updated. How about that? On the status of the next Sound Off. Until next time, be well, stay safe. If you are celebrating the Jewish holiday later in the week, Happy New Year. And we'll be right back here next time for another episode of the Solemnmonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solemnmonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.